Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2012. Lecture 23, delivered on April 17, 2012. The title of this lecture is Review for Exam 2.
Today, review for Exam 2. The format is the same as Exam 1. You'll have Part 1, multiple choice, 20 questions, 2 points each. Then Part 2, workout questions. Total value of Part 2 is 40 points. And then Part 3 is 5 short answer questions. You choose 4 of them to give me the answer to. Again, the same format, same rules apply. As far as the multiple choice questions go, we've actually covered a lot of material in this section of the course. It was a little more focused than the material in the first part of the course. Specifically, we were keying on decision making in the financial management environment. For example, we talked about such concepts as present value, future value, net present value. Those kinds of ideas were brought forth in this class. Yes. Oh, you're right. The float on that was 8%. Float on that problem was 8%. Thank you for reminding me of that. The float was 8%. Duh. Although I'm sure you should have been able to read my mind. Where the hell was I after I was interrupted with one of my mistakes? Now, let me go through a couple of things, and you'll revisit these in other parts of the exam, but in the multiple choice part of the exam, I began with a discussion of risk. Now, that had been going on from the first part of the course, but it was brought up again in the second part of the course. Risk specifically in terms of our metrics for risk. Now, in the first part of the course, you saw that one of our measures of risk was the coefficient of variation. That measured volatility. Now, in the second part of the course, we looked at risk in a slightly different way through the lens of what is called beta. Beta is the measure of the non-diversifiable risk of a stock relative to the market portfolio. So be sure that you are aware of the difference between diversifiable and non-diversifiable risk. And know that when I say diversifiable risk, I could also use the term non-systematic risk. And non-diversifiable risk, I could use the term systematic, in the system risk, the risk that cannot be gotten rid of. Therefore, the risk that for which you should expect a reward. Know what beta means, a beta of 1.25. That means the security under consideration has a non-diversifiable risk that is 125% of the market portfolio. Again, a beta of 1.25 means that the non-diversifiable risk of the security is 125% of the risk of the market portfolio. Now, I went to a larger discussion of the capital asset pricing model. make sure you know what is meant by the different parts of it. When I say case of M minus case of F, that is the expected premium over of the market portfolio over risk-free. The expected premium of the market portfolio over risk-free. Now remember, everything is expectations. I brought up a couple of issues with respect to beta. Can a beta be zero? What would have a beta of zero? There's actually an instrument out there that has a beta of zero. What would have a beta of exactly one? There's an instrument out there that has a beta of exactly one. Is it theoretically impossible for a beta to be less than zero? Is it possible for a beta to be greater than one? Make sure you know what that beta means if you are looking at investments, looking at stocks or mutual funds or ETFs. You are going to shape your approach to investment relative to your preference for risk on beta. It's your best measure for assessing the risk of something. So if I bought a stock with a beta of 0.5, well, let me approach someone here who looks trying to ignore me. You, sir, I haven't bothered you at all this semester, and you look sufficiently Yeti that I need to. Sir, if I buy a stock with a beta of 0.5, that means that it has half the risk of the market portfolio, right? So buying that stock would mean that I'm taking half the risk of the market portfolio. Is that right?
Sure.
Say no.
No.
No, good. That's very good. Yeah, okay. You would say, are you out of your mind, Prof? No, because, I mean, every stock has both a systematic, that's a non-diversifiable risk component. That's what beta is measuring. But every stock has a non-systematic, diversifiable risk component. So you could buy a stock that is indicating safety, 0.5, that's a pretty safe stock, and you could take what is technically called in the business an ass bath. Because that stock could have a whole lot of wild volatility in it. And you're saying, well, look at that volatility. Why is the beta only 0.5? Because the component that is non-diversifiable risk is 0.5. The rest of it is just insane. I mean, this guy, he could be a Presbyterian deacon, but he's also a werewolf on full moon nights. So, you know, you say, Presbyterian deacon, he's going to be safe to bring home for dinner. Happens to be a full moon, and the house is a mess. You know, he craps all over the place, pees on the furniture, and he tries to eat your wife. So, you know, that beta is a warning that, yeah, this is that beta comes with a warning. That means in a well-diversified portfolio, it will perform as if it has the half the risk, half the volatility of that big, huge, massive market portfolio, but not on its own. Now, remember, I brought up some instruments. Remember the idea of diversification, and that's a theme that if you take other courses in finance, or even if you read some of the better websites and experts about investments, you have to get into diversification. Ideally, you will buy every stock in the economy, and you will buy it in its proportionate weight to its contribution to the economy. So Microsoft, you would buy what? 80% of your portfolio would be Microsoft. No, it wouldn't be that much. But these big monster companies would contribute quite a bit of the portfolio, and then every other company would be a little bit of weight in it. Now, okay, that's theoretically a perfectly diversified portfolio, but you don't need to do that. Once you have purchased over a certain number of shares, you've shaken out a lot of the non-systematic risk. Do you happen to remember right off the top of your head, you, madam, how many stocks I threw out as taking away a lot of that non-systematic risk? If you wanted to make your own portfolio, what would be that
number of shares of stock. Do you remember a number I threw out? You never listen to me. I talk and I talk till I'm blue in the face. Lord knows I might as well talk to the dog. He doesn't listen to me either, but if I tie a pork chop around my neck, at least he likes me. Okay. Anyone remember the number I threw out? 30. That's always been an old school rule of thumb. You get about 30 stocks that are not that are relatively unrelated to each other, and you get 30 stocks that are around a beta of 0.5, you're going to have a portfolio that is, you've shaken out most of that risk that you won't get rewarded for, and you've got a portfolio that has a beta of about half of the market risk. So about maybe 30 stocks. Now, if you don't want to get the problem with buying stocks individually, okay, what is the big problem with buying stocks individually? Do you remember what I told you about that? It's just sort of a logical thing. Do you remember what I told you about buying stocks individually, what your big problem is with that? It's brokerage fees, transactions fees. You know, when you buy a lot, you know, you can manage your own portfolio. You can feel really butch about it. And when you go to a finance singles bar, that's a selling point. I manage my own portfolio. No, you can do it, but you've got that cost involved. And also, you've got the opportunity cost of your time in constructing the portfolio and keeping it balanced, which is something that we go into in a little bit more advanced courses. Now, what are there? Are there instruments out there that you can buy that would actually mimic portfolios? There are two that I brought up, two different approaches you can take. If you don't want to buy individual stocks to build a diversified portfolio, there are two different approaches you can take that can create the effect of diversification without buying lots of different stocks on your own. Do you remember what they were? You need to know that for the exam. Do you remember any what they possibly were? ETFs and bingo, ETFs and mutual funds. The downside on what was the downside on mutual funds? Well, you remember what the downside on the mutual funds was? You brought that one up. It's that you can only move in, around mutual funds a couple of times a year. You have these windows. So in other words, if the zombie apocalypse happens and you're not in your window, you cannot move your portfolio to zombie-proof stocks. ETFs, they are actually like stocks. You can call and buy an ETF, and the ETF could be like the Standard & Poor's 100 or the Dow. Or you can buy ETFs that are essentially nothing but indices of stocks, and choose your risk level based upon what kind of an index you want to buy into. Like if you bought into a broad, small cap ETF, that'd probably have a lot of risk. Highly diversified, fine. If you bought into something like the Standard & Poor's 500, you'd have great diversification, lower risk. You can choose your risk that way. The downside is that they are stocks. So there you are with those transactions fees. You can trade day and night, any day of the year. You don't have a window. It's just like a stock. Except that, of course, just like a stock, you'll pay a broker fee every time you buy or sell. So that's the downside. The bottom line, though, is this. You shouldn't be buying and selling all that often. Hot stock tips and all of that kind of nonsense, those are for the people who give the hot stock tips so that you'll pay them money for their hot stock tips. If they really, really knew what was going on, they would keep their pie holes shut about what's going on. Trust me on that. The point is that the best strategy that any investor can make, notwithstanding good, strong, high-power technical analysis, is buy and hold. Moving your portfolio as your life changes, but not just because you feel like shifting your portfolio around. Rebalance, yeah, but other than that, no. Now, let me go on to some other topics that will, I brought that up because I will probe your understanding of that stuff in the multiple choice and in the essay to some extent as well. I want to make sure that you understand
the relationship between bond yield and bond price. I will, in part two, I will have you find the price of a bond, and I will have you find the yield on a bond. But in part one, I will be testing your knowledge of the relationship. Know what is meant by a bonds quote. If I were to say that the quote is 98.50, what would you say? Is that bond selling at a premium, discount, what? That's not selling at a discount. What would it mean if the price were exactly par? This bond selling at par. Why would that happen? How could that be the case? A bond that is right on the money at 100. What would be the reason for that to happen? I'll ask you about that in the multiple choice. I'll probe you on a couple of quick little formulas like perpetuities. Where would I use a perpetuity formula? Price, what would I price using a perpetuity? What is it? Preferred. With just a flat perpetuity, preferred. A perpetuity with growth for a common stock. Because a perpetuity that's flat is just a preferred stock. It pays you the same amount every year, forever and ever and ever. And that amount is based upon the percent of the declared percentage and on the par value of the common. Now, as far as other things go in the multiple choice, I will throw at you a question where I will want you to find a net present value. And I will throw at you a follow-up question where I'll ask for the internal rate of return. In terms of volatility, I brought up another kind of volatility measure. Degrees of leverage, the degree of operating leverage, the degree of financial leverage, and the degree of combined leverage. I would anticipate that in the second part of the exam, you will have a problem where you will use those three stupid formulas to get me the DOL, degree of operating leverage, the degree of financial leverage, and the degree of combined leverage. In the multiple choice part, I will revisit and integrate why the degree of combined leverage could be more than the degree of operating or financial leverage. Remember that DOL times DFL equals DCL. So they contribute, each of them. DOL contributes through the fixed cost of operations. DFL contributes through fixed interest payments, and put together, they can, if they're both greater than one, magnify volatility at the sales line down at the net income line. I will probe marginal cost of capital in the multiple choice. I will ask you the relationship between marginal cost of capital and weighted average cost of capital. And I will remind you that the first marginal cost of capital is the weighted average cost of capital at the optimal capital structure. So again, remembering that the first marginal cost of capital you calculate will be the weighted average cost of capital at your optimal capital structure. what must be the relationship overall between your MCCs and your WACC? If I tell you the number of breakpoints, you should be able to tell me the number of levels of MCC. Again, if I tell you the number of breakpoints, you should be able to tell me the number of levels of MCC. If I told you that a company can borrow up to $2 million at 6%, from $2 to $5 million at 8%, and above $5 million at 10%, and it can use internal equity or sell common stock. Again, it can borrow up to $2 million at 6%, from 2 to 5 million at 8%, and above 5 million at 10%. And it combines the debt with equity that it generates through its sales or through selling common stock. How many breakpoints will there be? Talk to me. In other words, again, it can borrow up to $2 million at 6%, from 2 to 5 million at 8%, and above 5 million at 10%. And it combines its borrowed money with its net income stuff after dividends, and then after that through selling common stock. How many breakpoints are there going to be? Yeah, I'll tell you how many there are. Okay. Breakpoint one is from borrowing one at $2 million. Breakpoint two is at $5 million. Breakpoint three is when it switches from that money that it generated internally to selling common stock. So there'd have to be three breakpoints. You notice that the problems I've given you so far in here, and the one that would be on the test, you have two levels of debt cost, and then your equity internal, and then your new equity. That created two breakpoints. So now all I've done is I've thrown in an extra thing with borrowing money. So that just creates a third breakpoint. That's all. If you think about it, there's a rule in there. There's a rule in there. But you have to think about it. I could do it, they could sell preferred stock too. How many breakpoints would that create? Well, another way of raising money, that just created another breakpoint. So if I did the problem I just gave you, but I said they could also raise money through preferred stock, then there'd be four breakpoints. Oh, a mother's work is never done. Okay, that's enough for multiple choice. Let me go on here. Part two. Now, remember in this part of the course, I did time value of money, annuities, and perpetuities. I will have you calculate a present value or a future value. I'll give you some numbers for each year. They could be at the beginning of the year or the end of the year. Know what that means for whether it's an ordinary or an annuity due. It'll be no more than about, I think it'll be no more than about five. 5 years of numbers. And I'll just say, okay, this is what's going to happen. $3 million the first year, $2 million the second year, $8 million the third year. And all I'm going to ask you to do is find me either the present value or the future value. And you got to watch out for when I'm saying that the cash occurs each year.
If it starts at the beginning of the year, it's an annuity due. You go down and make sure that you put the right button on your calculator in the TVM solver. If I say that the cash flows or each of these components is happening at the end of the year, you'd have to put it at the that button right there, that facility at the end, you'd have to put on end. Because then it'd be an ordinary annuity. It'll be just a quick, dirty question. I am also going to have you calculate a loan payment on a consumer loan. Perhaps one of the most practical things you can do, you can learn in this class, is I'm going to say it's something like you're borrowing money for a house or for a car. I'm going to give you the APR, number of years, and always assume it's monthly payments. I'm going to say, what's your payment? What's your payment? And then I'm going to ask you for the effective rate on it. That was from the first exam, but it cleans it up. In disclosures on loans, the loan company actually has to report to you what the effective rate is. Remember, the effective rate would be 1 plus the APR divided by 12, and then you raise that value to the 12th power and subtract 1. I'm going to have you find the price of a share of stock. I'm going to give you a growth rate, and I'm going to give you the components of cap M get the discount rate. I'll give you the dividend. Now watch it. Remember, when you price stock, you have to use the dividend at period 1. If I give you the dividend at period 0, you have to grow that 1 period. So you have to do 1 plus G. But I might give you the dividend at period 1. You've got to read the problem. And then to get the discount rate so that you can do the D1 over P all plus G, you're going to have to get your discount rate, and I'll give you the cap M information, K sub F, K sub M, and beta. I'm going to have you find degree of operating leverage, degree of financial leverage, and degree of combined leverage. Remember the three formulas I gave you. I'll give you 2010 and 2011 financials. Just real quick stuff, and all you have to do is pick off, get the delta sales, delta EBIT, and delta NI, and then go ahead, percent on those, and then go ahead and calculate them out. And then I'm going to give you a marginal cost of capital question. You will have the narrative for it. You will have the narrative for it tomorrow morning. It will be on Blackboard. And what you'll be doing, I'll have you calculating the component cost of capital. You'll report the component cost of capital. You will report the marginal cost of capital. You will report the breakpoints. And then finally, you will give me the decision as a complete sentence using the names of the projects, because I will name the projects because this comes from an actual problem. So that if you're answering someone who says, I need you to give me the what projects we accept, you don't just send back an email saying, Project D. You say, we should accept the Terraline Commons and the Laredo Luxury, or something like that. Okay, here we go. Now for the essays. I'll give you the ones, most of them will come from this. There might be some that would not be in what I'm going to give you here. I'll give you about 10 possibles.
What is the relationship between the time to maturity of a bond and its price? Again, what is the relationship between the time to maturity of a bond and its price? Why do some companies avoid preferred stock as a source of capital? Why do some companies avoid preferred stock as a source of new capital? Distinguish between diversifiable and non-diversifiable risk with respect to expected return. Again, distinguish between diversifiable and non-diversifiable risk with respect to expected return. Let you catch up there for a second. I see people writing pretty fast there. That with respect to expected return. What is meant by the market portfolio? What is meant by the market portfolio? What is meant by the risk-free rate? What is meant by the risk-free rate? What was the Modigliani-Miller proposition? In one sentence, all of these are grammatically correct. And this one, it's actually very easy to answer. What it was the Modigliani-Miller proposition? Why is the Modigliani-Miller proposition not seen in the real world? Why is the Modigliani-Miller proposition not seen in the real world? In other words, why don't we see companies that are 100% debt? Debt is cheaper than equity. Why don't we see every company being 100% debt? Because why would a company use capital like use sources of capital like stock when stock is so darned expensive? What are the advantages and disadvantages of ETFs versus mutual funds? What are the advantages and disadvantages of ETFs versus mutual funds? What does beta measure? What does beta measure? Why is net present value, as a rule, preferable to internal rate of return? And one more, what is the relationship between net present value and internal rate of return? What is the relationship between net present value and internal rate of return? Now, I warn you on that last one, and on all of these, don't go five times around the barn to get to the outhouse. You have one sentence to answer it. I actually have a bullshit stamp, and I will use it this time. I promise you. Some people think it's a collector's item to get a bullshit. They sell them on eBay or something. I don't know. Don't try it. Say what you have to say. On that last one, the answer is fewer than 15 words, is about a 13-word sentence. Do you have any questions for me? Yes. 8 through whatever. 8 through marginal cost of capital. Other questions? Now, I did touch a little bit of 8 before that in exam 1, but when I got to the annuities, now we're in exam 2. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.